Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by chess.com, the world's largest chess community. And there's a really exciting and new release from chess.com that I've enjoyed using. It's called Classroom. This feature allows you to easily go over a game live with a friend or a club member that you just played. And you can do so interactively on the board with both of you on video talking to each other. It's also a great way to have a lesson between a student and a coach. And you can check that out on chess.com/classroom. Welcome to this week's episode. I have an awesome guest for you. You may have already heard her on her own podcast. She's the well-known co-host of the show Chess Feels, Julia Rios. Here's a little background if you're not familiar with her. Julia is a clinical psychologist. Currently, she's a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University's School of Medicine. And like many of us, she's also a club-level chess player. 2 years ago, she launched the Chess Feels podcast with her co-host, chess coach JJ Lang. I recommend listening to their excellent show if you haven't already, as it's truly a unique chess podcast. The Chess Feels show wonderfully blends humor, casual conversation, and critical topics on chess and psychology that you just don't get anywhere else. And no surprise, in this episode, Julia and I discuss at length some of the key issues at the intersection of chess and psychology, like rating obsession, losing, and the pressure to always be improving. But we managed to balance that with a good dose of humor and laughter. Here's my interview with Julia. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Julia. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Hi, Daniel. I'm excited to be here.
Well, with you as a guest this week, this is sort of now becoming my year of crossover podcast episodes because a few months ago I had Ben Johnson on. He was the first time I had another chess podcast host on, and now I have you as a guest. So I'm really excited about that and excited to chat with you too. I always, I really enjoy talking to other podcast hosts. Maybe that's biased.
No, I totally agree. It is so nice, and I feel very honored to be put in the same category as Ben, obviously.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is all, anyway, just a part of kind of like a roundabout sneaky plan to get invited on everyone else's podcast, basically.
Oh, do you like that, Daniel, going on other people's shows?
Yeah, I do. I've only been on one other chess podcast, which is Kevin's Chess Journeys.
Oh, excellent. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's pretty natural, right? Like, I wouldn't run a chess podcast if I didn't like being on them.
That's such a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Now I basically instantly agree. It didn't feel immediately obvious to me because I can definitely imagine, I guess when I ask other people to come be a guest, I always wonder like if it feels like an obligation or like a burden or a task, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I worry about that too, but I definitely enjoy it myself, so maybe I should be less worried about that. Speaking of chess podcasts, the Chess Feels podcast is back on again after about a year off. How does it feel to be back?
Yeah, it feels good. It really does. We knew that we needed to take some time off for life transition stuff. I don't think either one of us wanted it to be or expected it to be a year. So I'm very, very glad to be back. I'm trying to not dwell on the fact that so much time had passed, but it really does feel great. I feel like as soon as we kicked back up again, it's been actually pretty easy and really nice just to swing back into that mode. And yeah, the response has been very touching. So yeah, it actually feels great.
That's great. Was it pretty easy coming back after about a year? Did it feel natural and like second nature at that point?
Yeah, I would say so. And, you know, when JJ and I started the podcast together, I almost feel like there actually wasn't too much of a learning curve. I don't know if maybe that means that there were things we were supposed to learn that we haven't learned, but I really do feel like JJ and I had this idea. And then one day in the conversations we were already having, we just hit record and we have loved both the process of doing it as well as the product that we get to put together. So it's just been, yeah. I mean, honestly, easy is a word that resonates with me.
That's great. That's great. Well, speaking of your conversations that you have with JJ, like, I've always been impressed at just how natural they come across, and just, it seems very improvisational and yet at the same time high quality. And I don't know how you manage to do both at the same time, but it's very impressive to me. Because usually when I improvise, it's not very good.
So, oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. So I guess a question I have, do you and JJ plan any of like the topics that you'll cover for episodes? That's my answer. I got it.
Yes, Daniel, we spend hours planning and scripting, and then we do a trial run and we practice.
No. Flow charts and everything?
No, definitely not. I'm glad it comes off as organic. It definitely is. We plan very, very little. And I think JJ and I have both really learned that the planning seems to get in the way. Maybe even like the opposite of what I hear you describing, where when it's kind of off the cuff and organic, there might be some kind of challenge there. But I think for us, when we try to be more kind of structured with it, we seem to just run into something.
It's more challenging when it's structured, huh?
Yes, definitely. And I feel like our favorite conversations almost always are coming out of the things that we kind of loosely know what we want to talk about, and then it unfolds, and then it ends up maybe being something even totally different, and we have to, you know, rethink what the episode title would even be. I love those conversations. Like, I love being able to follow the thread to what actually feels interesting, because otherwise I maybe start to feel a little stuck or cramped, or it just gets a little stuffy.
Yeah. Well, I love kind of seeing behind the scenes a little bit. You know, I've seen a lot of like just the great feedback that you get on social media for your podcast, and it's really cool to see that. I'm curious, like, what for you has been the most enjoyable aspect of hosting the Chess Feels podcast so far?
Oh, that's such a nice question.
I like the positive angle on things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, the very obvious one is I get to clown around with one of my closest friends in the world. I know that really comes through, like, how much JJ and I have a very genuine friendship. So I really enjoy talking to JJ. I think that that's part of what maybe translates onto the podcast, where people say, wow, these are very compelling conversations, or even that kind of, some people have used the word chemistry, so maybe sort of like that organic chemistry. It's just an experience I really enjoy. So I'm always down to, you know, postulate and pontificate with JJ. Of course, it's always nice to have people on and get those views too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, you two definitely have great chemistry together in your conversations. In terms of audience feedback, has there been anything that's been memorable or stood out to you, like on the positive side of things? Again, maybe just surprised that, you know, an episode or the podcast as a whole kind of, you know, impacted somebody.
Oh, yeah. You know, this actually came up in an interview that we did recently that'll probably get released even before this episode comes out with Isaac Haxton. And we were sort of reflecting on the fact that the one episode that has gotten, I would say, the biggest response, the most feedback, has really been our episode, episode number 14 on ADHD and chess. And I don't think either JJ and I were really ready for that episode to land the way it did. That one definitely felt off the cuff. There were actually parts of the episode that I even told JJ when we were done recording, I have to take that out. I can't leave that in. I really don't necessarily maybe want to disclose certain parts about my experience having ADHD and being diagnosed with ADHD. And it also felt very specific to me, because we are this chess and psychology podcast. Psychology is a very broad term. So I think there was part of me that said, you know, this might resonate with a very small part of our audience and people who have some type of personal or anecdotal experience with it. I don't think either one of us was ready for that to be the one episode where people reached out to us over and over again and just said, wow, this really resonated with me, or this really helped illuminate something, or this was an episode that really spoke to me in some kind of significant way. But that really has been the one.
Well, that's great to hear. And yeah, I mean, just speaking as, you know, a fellow podcaster, I find it difficult to predict what episodes are going to land with people.
Totally.
I mean, it's usually always the opposite. Like, the ones that I'm hopeful for, that's like, you know, not that it doesn't do well, but, you know, it just doesn't get like the quantity of audience feedback that I had hoped for, but then the flip can happen too. And so
Totally.
So, but okay, it is always,
so what's your estimate? How much clout are we going to get from this podcast crossover?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm always hopeful for every like episode I do, but
let me squash those hopes right now.
I don't know. I feel like this is a more unique type of episode for me, for my show. Like, you know, usually I'm,
yeah.
Well, first, I mean, usually most of my guests are titled players. I've done some adult improvers, but like I said, this is only the second time I've also only interviewed another chess podcast host. So I don't know. I hope people like seeing, those two worlds come together. That's my hope.
Yeah. Okay. Well said. Oh, you are such a, that was a very diplomatic response. I love it.
Was it? I didn't even mean to be.
Let me readjust those expectations right now. I will not be able to fill the shoes of Ben Johnson, but we'll do our best.
I don't know. I'm optimistic that we can get the same response, but that's just me.
All right, we're coming gunning for you, Ben. Here we go. Ben.
Poor Ben.
Ben knows I love him.
Speaking again about the chemistry that you have with JJ, there's something in particular I want to discuss about that, because I think it's kind of what stands out most to me about your show, which is you and JJ together, I think, have this great ability to combine chess with humor and a fun attitude. And I was always impressed by that because, you know, it strikes me as you two not taking all of this chess journey stuff too seriously. But I think
definitely
a lot of chess players struggle with that, with taking it too seriously. So I'm curious if you think, you know, a lot of adult improvers, maybe make that mistake a little bit where they get too hung up on everything that goes into it.
Yeah. I mean, part of me, Daniel, feels right off the bat, like that's kind of hard for me to speak to, because like you're very kind of correctly identifying, that's definitely not my experience. I'm not sure I have felt really heavily weighed down by that at any point since I really started to play a lot more chess and study chess and connect with other people in the chess community. I do see things that kind of allude to what you're describing, or yeah, hear things that people say that give me that sense. I would be really curious, actually, first, just to kind of punt it back to you and maybe hear you describe more like what that seriousness feels like. How do you approach it?
Yeah, I think part of it to me comes from the investment of time that you put in it. And
that feels like a type of pressure.
Yeah, well, at least an expectation, I think. Once you put in this amount of effort and time, you expect to get a certain amount of reward for it. And chess is notoriously not very good at delivering rewards.
Unrewarding, exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, the rewards that you get in terms of at least skill don't always line up with the time and energy you put into it. And right. I think that's what kind of creates that burden. That's what I think. And it's difficult, you know, it's difficult to just be lighthearted about it and say, well, I put 50 hours into it this month. It's cool. I didn't improve at all. That's fine.
Right. But I imagine in some of those moments, Daniel, you're saying there's a translation that's happening. So it comes out the other line as I didn't improve at all. But I imagine in those moments, what you're really saying or what you're really noticing is my rating didn't go up.
Yeah, and that's definitely something I want to talk about.
Yeah, so before we kind of go down that whole train of thought, because there's so much we could unpack, I do feel like you've already said so many things that are important. Like one, kind of thinking about what the expectations are. But this is like one of those things where, you know, my training in clinical psychology will really unfortunately shine through, but I just feel like we have to operationalize our terms.
Yeah, I'm
good
for that.
What does the energy look like? What does improvement look like? What are the expectations? And then what does it mean when we miss the goal? So there's so many assumptions that are happening. There's so many pieces of that puzzle that are gonna feel heavy to you beyond just like that surface level disappointment. Because of course we all want to get better. Of course we all want to reach that goal. But I hear what you're speaking to. There is a heaviness What does it mean when I don't? What does it mean about me, about my ability, about the time I spend doing this? Are those things worthwhile? So, I mean, that those are really big, challenging ideas, but I think it's worth bringing those unspoken kind of invisible pieces to the surface so that we can sort of call a spade a spade. Let's talk about what actually feels uncomfortable or disappointing in those moments.
Right. You know, and to be clear, this isn't anything I struggle with.
right. Yeah, no, hypothetically.
Yeah, this is just hypothetical. This is just what I hear other people say. I have no, you know, connection to this.
Right? Random Twitter user online probably is suffering. Not right. I.
Yeah. Well, man, I mean, you know, it's almost like we could create a whole podcast out of psychology and chess, right? yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly when to dive into that. I definitely want to discuss that stuff with you. But just to take it, I'll take it one step back for just for a moment, because I do think like everything that you just addressed, I think, you know, is stuff that people understand that that's what they're going through to some degree. They're putting this weight on themselves. Maybe they're creating expectations they shouldn't have. A lot of it tied to rating. And that's what creates that weight, I think, or a lot of it. And also, I think 100%. If I can answer, like now I'm on your podcast for a second, because I want to answer your question in another way of like what creates this. Like if you express a part of your chess journey, like, oh, I'm studying this, or I switch my opening to whatever, there's a lot of criticism that can come flooding in, and you just start to see that seriousness, even if when it's not related to rating, it's just, you know, here's what you should be doing. There's a lot of that. And I think that creates a burden too. But all of this is to say that that's why I find your podcast so refreshing, because you know, just laugh at a lot of this, which we should be doing more often. This is really not life and death stuff. This is, you know, a game that we are trying to get better at. Yeah. But it really doesn't matter too much how good we get. So I just really appreciate that from your podcast. And I wonder if that's part of your goal at all, or if that's just a natural expression of how you two, you know, converse.
Right. So I'm gonna tuck something in, Daniel. I'm gonna circle back to the second part of the question, but first I really want to respond to something that you said, which is I sort of understand that this can feel like it has a certain type of gravity or seriousness, but also we can zoom out and we can contextualize and notice that it doesn't matter that much. And maybe it seems like that's sort of how JJ and I approach it. But I think I would really push back on that a little bit. I mean, I think this stuff matters. I think it can matter a lot. And I think it's cool when it matters. And I think it's really cool when people care. And so it's not maybe like the caring or the weight that people put that might be creating some of the distress that you feel. Maybe what I'm trying to get at is that it's not necessarily that it matters that is creating the problems, but what does it mean that it matters? Can I care about something very deeply and invest my time and invest my energy and give it a lot of attention and effort and also not always get the outcomes that I want, or not always achieve or perform in the way that I wanted to, or not do that consistently, or not do it as well as the person I'm comparing myself to online? So the caring is an incredible thing, but I think that there's all these layers that get piled on top of it about what the game of chess and my performance actually means that are maybe contributing to that type of seriousness that I hear you describing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. You said it does matter. Why does it matter?
Well, why does anything matter?
Fair enough.
Right? It's like, yeah. That's a really hard thing to try to intellectualize. It sounds silly. It sounds like I'm being tongue in cheek, but truly, why does anything matter? Why does chess matter? Why does anything in our life matter? Why do our relationships matter? People can answer that a lot of different ways. The way it brings pleasure, joy, connection, vitality, you know, we can attach all these words to it, but at the end of the day, it matters because it matters. It matters because it feels fulfilling and it adds meaning to our life.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. If I can add to that, I think, and I'll take a stab at my own question.
Oh, I love it.
But I want to get your feedback on what I think. I think it matters anytime we pour, you know, heart and soul into something that we care about.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that almost feels like it might touch like a true correlation, but reverse the direction of causality? Is it that we pour our heart and soul in because it matters?
Or the reverse.
Maybe you and I could wrestle with it. We got to bring JJ on. We need a philosopher here to keep score. I think it's super interesting. We don't need to spend a lot of time thinking about it, but there is something that feels very primary about the mattering, and there might be a need to justify it. It matters because I put in enough time and effort and energy and I studied, so therefore this is important.
Right.
But I almost think that might essentially be subtractive in some way to the mattering. And it also creates this sort of idea around it that I have to do those things for this to hold that meaning, for it to matter. And I actually think that might not really represent the true relationship that we either have or want to have to something that we love.
Yeah. Wow. This got deeper than I expected.
Totally. But we can use another example. So there might be a way to highlight this. Like, you can think about the people in your life. Are you in a relationship, Daniel?
Yeah, I'm married.
Great. So you're married. So you can think about your spouse. Why does your spouse matter? Does your spouse matter because you intertwined your lives and you spend all this time doing nice things for her and because of how much you love her? Or does she matter because she matters and that's why you do all those things? It's like, it is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. A lot of self-reflection happening right now.
I'm so sorry. We can like totally no. zoom out. Can I add some context for our listeners? I tried to warn Daniel about this, but we are recording this after I just did 7 straight hours of clinical work. And so I am like 100% still in clinical psychology, psychotherapy mode. So I can like unbutton a little bit too.
No, that's totally fine. I imagine that would have an effect if that's where your head has been all day, for sure.
1000%. It's hard to set shift.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to kind of, I guess go into a little bit of a different topic, but never completely different because it's all going to be under chess. So I know that this past year in 2023, you largely had to step away from playing and studying chess. Nonetheless, when I posted on Twitter earlier today asking what questions people had for you.
That's right. Outsource blame. Go ahead.
Right. Yes, exactly. Well,
that's good for psychological health. I'm serious.
Yeah. The godfather, if you will, of adult chess improvers, God. Neil Bruce, wanted to know, how's your chess journey going?
I mean, pretty badly. But that sort of depends on how you measure it, right? I know what Neil is asking when he asks that. I know his frame of reference is, how is chess improvement going? Are you getting better? Are you playing the way you want to play? Are you playing a lot? There's all these ways that we might measure it. And by those metrics, like, things are going so bad. They've never been worse. I literally do nothing besides play Blitz Bullet and Hyper Bullet. Really rare that I even try to fit in a 10-minute game. I've joked on podcasts before, that feels like classical right now. So the truth is that I'm absolutely not getting better. My bullet rating is going up, but there's actually a very real chance that my actual chess ability is going down. I think I am picking up bad habits, and that is a that is a train that has already left the station.
Well, you said something really interesting about Neil here and what he's probably asking between the lines, which is, how is your chess improvement going? And you can certainly, if someone wants to, define their journey that way. But I'm wondering, to what extent, Julia, you define your chess journey by improvement?
Right. How do I think about my chess journey? I mean, even using the word journey is so loaded, right? It's really interesting. It makes us feel like we are on this, we are on, what's the word I'm looking for?
It sort of implies a destination, I feel. Like, you're trying to head towards something specific. That's at least how I interpret it in my head.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we're like on this voyage somewhere, and there's a destination, there is a conquest, I don't know. But it feels very active in that way. And with journeys, there's a beginning, a journey, and an end. I know that that's not really what's intended when people ask that, and it might feel like I'm being really pedantic, but I just think it touches like the way I'm framing it overall, because in a sense, I maybe have like totally zoomed out and fallen off the cliff, but I don't even really feel like I'm on a journey. So maybe that's my response to sweet, innocent Neil. I'm so sorry to drag you through the mud into all of this discourse, but my response is almost like, what journey? There's no journey right now.
Well, you know, that's definitely a fair response and one that I appreciate. I typically use the term chess life. I don't know if that's better or not. But for me, it just means like that part of your life that involves chess. Like, how is it going? Like, what's happening there?
What's happening? Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think it kind of removes that whole destination part. Like, you should be headed somewhere. It's just like what you're doing.
Yeah. I don't think that journey is a bad term either. I imagine that really resonates with people, particularly people who feel like they're on a journey. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's one lens. It's like one framework to think about it. I like chess life. Yeah. I'm not sure that I would really know what I would refer to it as for myself. I'll have to think about that.
any part of your life that involves chess. That's how I think of it. Even if that's just blitz all the time, right? I mean, that's what it is.
I was going to say, like, just playing bullet in the shower count.
I would count it as that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then if you think about it that way, asking how's it going? I don't know. It's sort of like, is inherently like, well, good. It's going.
It's going. Well, that's good.
I mean, maybe a way to answer that is like, I do enjoy chess when I get to play it. I really, really do. I love playing bullet. I think it's really fun. I get a little tickle when I have like a break in between meetings. And I get to hit 1-0, and it does bring a lot. I do also feel that sense of what's missing. Like, I really do miss taking lessons with JJ, really intensively studying chess. I miss playing slow games. I miss analyzing games. I miss all those pieces. But the truth of the matter is that when those things started to fall by the wayside, it wasn't because necessarily I was bored with those things or I didn't want to be doing them. It was just that so many other parts of my life kind of crowded in and pushed them out. So my life feels really full. It's kind of hard to feel that sense of missing when I'm doing so many things that are important to me and engaging with so many things that I love every day. So it's just, it's like confusing. It's I'm maybe kind of over intellectualizing it.
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, I find this really refreshing. And I think it's a really important topic, actually, because I think, Julia, some of what you were saying is that there's sort of this, at least in the online chess community, I don't know, I'll speak to that at least, maybe a bit of implicit pressure to always be improving or to be at least working on improving. And
sure.
I don't know. It seems like, based on what you're talking about, I think there should be more space for people who just want to do chess without worrying about improvement or how many hours they logged that week. But there doesn't seem to be much space for that. Like, if that's your version of, for lack of a better phrase, I'll use my own, if that's your chess life where you just do chess but don't care at all about improving or just maybe don't have the time for it, I don't know. I think that should be just as valid and just as honored.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. And maybe there's something too, Dana, that I feel myself bristling against. To even be thinking or talking about it that way, it feels so categorical. And the truth of the matter is that all of these things are very fluid. They're very dynamic. They're changing. They interlap. They intersect. They come in and go. Sometimes chess will check that box for me of fun and play and leisure. And sometimes it will check the box of mastery and learning. And both of those things will feel fulfilling, again, to come back to that word. Sometimes they'll be happening at once. Sometimes they will be compartmentalized. But there's a real utility to bringing in a type of flexibility in the way we think about it and trying to actually avoid thinking or talking about it in a way that is so rigid and conclusive. Because I think that just simply is not how we tend to move through the world. And if we hold ourselves to those boxes, then we start to run into like a little bit of discontent. There's a real benefit to that sort of ease and fluidity.
Yeah. And I don't really see that anywhere in the community, at least at large. I don't see that there's that acknowledgement for that fact. It does seem very rigid, like you said. And I think that's sort of the nature of the online chess culture that I see.
Right. Which makes sense, right? Because at the end of the day, we have to call things something. Like, we do have to label it. There's a usefulness in categories, but I just think that it is a limited usefulness. There's so many reasons. I mean, you and I could just totally go off on this other tangent about how Twitter specifically, for example, might tend to lean into things that do feel more reductive and more kind of conclusive in that way. There's a literal character limit. It's not a thing where nuance and sort of like a tepid opinion about something with a lot of context and a lot of hedging is going to invite more engagement. So, I mean, I think everyone can really understand that right at the surface.
I thought that was going to get me 200 likes when I tweeted that way, but I guess not.
Right? I'm really having fun and enjoying playing chess tonight. Maybe I'll study tomorrow, send tweet. Everyone's like, shut up.
Yeah, it's definitely a specific view that dominates in chess Twitter, for sure.
And that view to you, Daniel, is kind of what you started the conversation with of you, quote unquote, should be improving.
Right.
Or yep. You should focus on improving.
Right. Yeah. That there's definitely like this duty or something. If you're going to engage with chess, then you should be improving. Like, the two go together. Right.
Yeah. And as soon as you feel yourself using that word, should, that should be the ding, ding, ding alarm bell that goes off to indicate that you are going to be putting yourself in a type of very rigid framework that absolutely will cause you, I don't know, distress might be too strong a word, but there's just limitations there. As soon as the word should creeps in, as soon as you are thinking I should do something, why? It's like an important thing to push up against.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, I'm not really trying to bring myself too much in the conversation, but
no, please do.
But I think, you know, it can kind of help add to what we're talking about. Like, over the past couple of years, my own chess life has evolved. I was able to do it a lot more. I was able to focus on improvement a lot more intensely in the first year or two. But then this past year, I've had some health struggles. And so that's really limited what I can do. And I felt disconnected from the whole improvement.
Yeah,
disconnected from the whole improvement community in a way, because I couldn't say what I was improving on and I couldn't bring up new ideas or thoughts about it because I wasn't able to focus on that. And it felt awkward. It felt weird. And I realized that that maybe it shouldn't matter. It always mattered to me before, but I realized maybe it shouldn't matter whether I'm improving or not, or whether I have the time for it, the ability. But that was like kind of a revelation for me.
But I just want to point out to you that you've just made an interesting shift from what I should do and noticing the ways that that might not work, that pressure, I should be improving, I should be posting in a way, to, well, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I should not. So you went from should to should not. Unfortunately, those will function in the same way that will not set you free.
Mm, interesting. Interesting. So what's the better approach?
Yeah, like, what's the alternative? When you're thinking about should and should not, you'll first run into trouble because there's just a way that it's going to be really black and white. It's going to feel like all or nothing. It's going to feel very reductive and categorical, like we've been talking about. And in a sense, if we really zoom out, if I can just be very broad, that has a tendency to make these aspects and facets of our life smaller and not bigger, more narrow and less expansive. So we might already have a lot of reasons to not necessarily want to move in that direction.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing to pay attention to is that usually when we're using this framework of what I should or what I should not, what I must or what I must not do, that's typically going to be in orientation to something outside of myself, to something external, to some type of imperative. That's going to really get in the way of something that looks a lot more like self-inquiry and self-reflexiveness or self-responsiveness. It's a totally different framework. So you're asking me, what else is there? What's the alternative to should or should not? And it's just something that's like not going to exist on that axis. It's not going to be on that spectrum. It would be a totally different set of questions. We're not looking for a different answer. We're looking for a different question, which is, what is important to me right now? What do I care about? What do I have the capacity for? What direction would I like to move? what are my values? What's important? What are my goals? And how can I orient that to what is going on inside of me and the context of my life, as opposed to this general idea of some vague social imperative of what I should or should not do?
Wow. I love that. Those are great questions. I think when I go back and listen to your answer, I'm going to have to like write those down, because I absolutely love those. Those are really powerful.
And the beautiful thing is that sometimes, or maybe even often, the answer will be improvement and learning and engaging in a specific way. But if it feels like that is the only door in the hallway, you're going to feel pushed through it. You don't have the choice to walk around and find another door.
I love it. That's great. That's really insightful. And
okay, cool. I can't tell if I'm almost taking your questions a little bit too literally. I have a tendency.
No, not at all. I love it. I love this perspective. I really do. I mean, you're the only guest I've ever had who could provide this, and I think it's fantastic.
Cool.
A question I had for you is that, you know, I know that like a lot of people, like you had like a spike in your interest in chess, you know, as you mm-hmm. got older, like in that kind of that Queen's Gambit era that a lot of us came from. and to my understanding, like that was kind of like when you, like that was probably a peak for you in like your focus on the game in your life up to that point. And so in that period, were you at all surprised by how much psychology goes into this game? Because I feel like a lot of regular adult improvers who aren't psychologists kind of struggle with that, or like kind of hit by it almost, that it's like, wow, I've got to deal with all these psychological issues. But for someone with your background, did it surprise you at all?
God, I'm so sorry, Daniel. I want to be able to give you a pithy soundbite. I want to answer your question. I hear myself being annoying.
No.
This is really hard for me to answer, because I think that some of the things that you're asking me to reflect on feel really invisible to me. I wasn't thinking very deeply or noticing the psychology of what was happening for me. Like, I think I respond to those things maybe very differently. I did have days that felt frustrating. I definitely did have days where I would do a self-comparison, but I respond to those things really quickly. I notice them, and I think that I don't know. They don't feel super sticky for me. I don't think I've ever really experienced this type of like very tortured psychological relationship in reaction to anything that's happened in my life related to chess, which is not to say I don't experience that in different areas. I really, really do. But I think maybe the thing that has felt more surprising is what I hear from other people about how they experience it. And just to be really authentic in how I respond to the question, I am not sure that I actually experience those things the same way, even though I can really understand and relate to how someone else might describe experiencing it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the honesty on that.
And maybe we can be more specific too, Daniel. Like psychology, like of course there's psychology involved. I'm thinking, I have a nervous system. Maybe we can sort of parse this down and talk about what are those psychological phenomena that we're talking about when people say they struggle with the psychology of chess?
Yeah, right. Well, to me, like a few stand out. I think we hit on one already, which is the improvement pressure that people feel. But I think others would include dealing with losing in chess. I think maybe that's the biggest one that stands out to me in terms of frequency that people talk about. Being frustrated with the progression of your rating.
Or maybe even thinking about the emotionality or that type of level of arousal or hyper arousal that shows up in a chess game that can feel like it distracts from the ability to really do that type of deep calculation and cognitive processing that we think of as being more central to chess. That's what we think of.
Right. And, you know, I think with losing in chess, I almost feel like that's too broad, because I feel like there are several emotional slash psychological places that you can go from a loss, and they're not all necessarily the same. In fact,
totally.
I recently did a solo episode on this show about how to deal with losing in chess, and I used advice that I got from other people to talk about it. But one thing I included in that episode was trying to unpack a little bit like the different reasons why you might feel upset after a loss. And so I try to kind of break that down. I think it came up with about four or five different reasons. So to me, losing in chess is not just like a singular issue. I don't know what, if you agree or not.
Oh, of course. Nothing is a singular issue. Of course, I agree vehemently. And all the things we've just outlined, Daniel, I do sort of want to tuck in, like, yes, of course I feel those. But to respond to your original question, which was, does that surprise you? Or almost like, what's my reaction to that?
Mm-hmm.
It's just to say, like, no, of course not. Of course it doesn't surprise me. I think it speaks to this idea that we expect those things to be compartmentalized. And so some people might feel surprised at this game that we think of as being very analytical and very concrete and very intellectual wouldn't have all of these other facets of human psychology. But I, as a clinical psychologist, of course, do not come in with that expectation. So maybe that's what I meant when I'm trying to say it feels a little bit invisible, like the shock factor of it is the invisible part. Of course, I'm expecting all those things. So for myself, I kind of respond to them relatively quickly and automatically, sometimes more and less. But I hear you sort of nodding to the fact that for a lot of people, they might not come in with this expectation that it's going to stir up so much. And Definitely. Then that might be the piece that you're then sort of going towards next, that part of you that's trying to unpack it and say, okay, this thing is here that I wasn't expecting. Why is this bringing up so many intense reactions inside of me that I wasn't expecting?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that still stands out to me that I'm trying to maybe figure out, because I don't know whether chess is unique in that way or not. It sounds like you lean towards the idea that it isn't unique in that way. But maybe
not.
Just flat out. Yeah. But and yet,
I mean, it's interesting because we actually I'm sorry. It's like funny to me because I in my head, I'm like, oh, didn't we already cover this? And I realized, like, no, of course we didn't. But we're just talking about the same thing. We're talking about two sides of the same coin. We've already established that I care. This means a lot to me. As soon as I am invested, I am opening myself up to the entire range of the nearly infinite human experience. And
that's true.
That means I'm going to care and I'm going to celebrate and I'm going to feel the connection. And I'm also going to feel the pain of the losses and the disappointment and the stress and the frustration. So unfortunately, we don't get to pick cafeteria style. We open up and we get to experience that. So to me, it feels like the most obvious thing in the world.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, when you say that, it makes perfect sense to me. And I can't find anything to disagree with about that.
And yet, you're like, I don't want to feel pissed off.
And yet, I don't know. Like, I've had several like skill-based endeavors in my life. And I find that chess has been more emotionally challenging for me overall. Not to say the others weren't at all. They definitely had their moments. But I just feel like, so it's not a difference to me of whether, you know, chess has emotional, psychological issues and other endeavors don't.
Yes, I follow. Like, is there something unique about chess that makes that particularly salient or intense? And yes, I think absolutely. I've talked about this on a number of podcasts, so I'm not going to say anything new or particularly interesting.
That's okay.
But I feel like with other people in the past, we've kind of wrestled with this, and there really do seem to be a few big factors that make chess maybe particularly emotionally evocative in a way that is actually not very obvious, exactly like you're describing. So the first big one that I feel like I just talk about over and over again is the rating. And I'll just keep repeating it because I think it's true. Unlike other hobbies and sports and types of recreation, there is a literal number that signifies where you fall in the hierarchy inside of your social community. That is so stressful. Can you imagine you have a bad day at soccer practice and then like your number, your like priority ranking goes down by one and everyone sees it?
Right.
That creates a type of pressure. So we respond to pressure. JJ and I have also talked about this way that the rating itself is so closely linked with identity. We don't say I have 1600 ELO. We say I am a 1600. It's not just semantics. It really represents something about how we feel about our rating and how that positions us in our social communities. So yeah, that's going to touch some really deep, really core places. I talk about this with my patients sometimes, and this is going to sound hyperbolic, and it's not. Social position, our connection with other people, and that type of acceptance to our nervous system evolutionarily feels like life or death. I know that sounds intense. Nothing is more important to survival than my acceptance into a tribe or into a community. For many, many years of my life, I literally require that type of attachment and acceptance, for example, from my primary caregivers, to live, like to open my eyes the next day. It feels important because it is important. So this aspect of the chest is going to brush up against that. It's going to touch that spot. There's going to be significant overlap, and you will feel the gravity of that.
Well, you know, it makes sense. I mean, when I hear you say that it has that kind of life and death response when you when you care about it that way, that it would elicit so much. Yeah.
I would also just tuck in, like, I feel like the other big one that we talk about that stirs up all that emotionality is another type of real pressure, which is with chess, you can just lose it all in the blink of an eye. I mean, how many things do we do on a daily basis where you can have a lapse in attention that is equal to 10 seconds and then everything goes in the toilet? Chess is a brutal, brutal game. It is relentless. It's merciless. I think that there is like a real pain and also a beauty in that, because when we succeed, like, it feels so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. That's something that's always fascinated me about chess. It's mercilessness, like you said.
Merciless.
You know, just that one mistake in a game can cause you to lose everything. And it's funny because there's so many chess and life analogies, and I love those analogies. But I feel like where the chess equals life analogy breaks down is this idea that if you do like everything right 99% of the time, but 1% you don't, you fail, you lose. That's and right. I feel like maybe we shouldn't translate that into life.
Right. Wait, what's your question around it, Daniel? Like, we can't translate it, you mean?
No, I feel like, no, I'm just kind of supporting what you're saying, which is that.
Right, yeah.
This is kind of a almost dangerous area of chess, which is that, like, it can so easily elicit, you know, heartbreak when you lose, because all it takes is one mistake.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. So some of the things that I'm saying is not about how do we immunize ourselves to heartbreak. It's almost like, how do we romanticize the heartbreak? How do we lean into the heartbreak? Just let yourself feel heartbroken. Feel that moment. It sucks. It's important. It's useful. You can lean into the people around you who have also had that similar same experience. And you, like, bring that into the fold as part of your chess journey.
Yeah, I love that. I love that concept. So, yeah, the question I wanted to ask you, going back to rating, is there a healthy way to care about your rating? Is it doomed from the start if you care about it?
Yeah, no, it's just, it's hard to answer because there's problems with the question. The question's actually making a lot of assumptions. The question's almost making the assumption that you could not care. I think that we should all take a bit of inventory and notice that it's a spectrum. It's not black or white. I care or I don't care. But to some degree, we are all going to care, and it is good to care. If we didn't care, we probably wouldn't stick around and we wouldn't be here. And I'm sure there are some people where they are playing without looking at their rating, or the famous person on Reddit who played like 150,000 games and never got above 1,500 on Lee Chess or something really hilarious. But what I'm more interested in exploring or asking is, we can notice that we do care. So how do we respond to the ways that we care and cultivate a relationship with chess and bring it into our life that lets us care deeply and engage with it in all the ways that we identified in our earlier exercise of a type of interoceptive awareness fit with our values and our goals and the things that we find fun and pleasurable and meaningful, which isn't always fun. And like really finding where all those things intersect. It's almost like, of course you care. Yes, it's totally okay to care. So if I'm asking, is it healthy or unhealthy to care. It almost doesn't matter because let's just take stock and notice I do care. So now what? Now that I do care, what do I want to come next? If you're noticing that the caring has a grip on me, I care so much about this number that it's creating dynamics in chess that are not moving me closer to the relationship with it that I want to have or the way I want to spend my time, that becomes the problem. That is the thing that we want to address. Not reducing the caring, mostly because that's just really hard to do. Man, I wish I had that light switch. You invent the drug that makes you not care about things you care about. There would probably be a market for that. I don't know how to do it.
Well, that is brilliant. I mean, that is like eye-poppingly insightful for me, at least.
Oh, great. Yeah, I never get feedback this far.
No, I never looked at it that way, but I love that. I mean, awesome. I even like wrote that down, what you said about how, you know, trying to align your caring with the goals and values that you want to have towards chess. That's
bingo. Yes, yeah. That's it. That's the secret ingredient. That's right.
That's amazing. I've never heard anyone say that. Yeah.
But that takes a lot of self-inquiry. Like, those are actually hard questions to answer. What is important to me here? Those might run into the social imperatives that we were talking about. Those might run into the things that I feel like I ought to care about or I should care about. And you might feel like you're swimming upstream. It still is an incredibly useful endeavor to take that time to reflect and go internal and like really look and see what's actually there for you. And yeah. To not just be responding to the social pressures. Like, those will always be there. Those will always push you in some direction if you are not swimming somewhere actively.
Wow. This is amazing. I love these insights, Julia. It's really great. So a couple of questions from Twitter followers. I know I kind of already threw one in early because it just fit better in the conversation earlier up front from Neil Bruce. Yeah, a couple of questions. One came in just a little bit before we started that I thought was interesting from Simon. He asks, what is Julia's favorite example where she has used her psychology skills/background to help someone with their chess? And he adds, help in any way on or off the board, but chess related.
Yeah, I mean, we have a whole episode, Simon, if you're interested. I think it's even episode 3. I think we did it really early. We kind of joked about chess psychology and doing therapy with JJ. And then we have a bunch more episodes where JJ has a good tournament or a rough tournament, and we start to use some of the psychological concepts that we talk about in theory and like really apply them to what's showing up. So actually, I guess I will also dangle out there, JJ and I have a unique episode coming up. It might be released kind of close to when this one comes out, which will be, I think, the 4th episode of our 3rd season, where we switch. JJ does therapy on me. So we do try to bring it up. We try to bring it in. I don't know. Let me throw this out there. If you're listening to this and I have personally and directly given you psychology advice that helped you with your chess, will you remind me so that I can put that on my resume when people ask me this question in the future? I met with Nate, do you remember this? I met with Nate, Nate Solon. We chatted about some of these ideas and he seemed very interested. I don't know. I feel like I'm not bold enough to say that it actually helped with anything, but I don't know. Maybe it did.
Yeah. So the other question comes from JJ, which I know you saw. JJ asks, what are some potential drawbacks to the self-help and self-improvement movements, and do you see them playing out in the chess adult improver spaces in particular? If so, what would some helpful reframing of chess study improvement goals look like?
Right. So the first question is what I feel like we've been talking about for an hour. Like, what are some of the drawbacks in this sort of framework or this orientation? So I'll let that sit. And everyone... Okay. Has already heard the conversation that we've been having so far about what those drawbacks kind of look like. But I like the second part, kind of that shift. Now that we've acknowledged the drawbacks, the limitations, right. what could a helpful reframing of chess study look like? And what could the improvement goals look like? So this is a really hard question to answer. You can tell that I have been doing my job all day because I start to have a really hard time talking about things conclusively that are not conclusive, things that are contextual. So what is a helpful reframing of chess study, and what would improvement goals look like? For who? Like, this depends so much. Who's sitting across from me? It goes back to what we've been saying this whole time. The answers to those questions need to be oriented to yourself, to what's important to you, to what your values are, to what your goals are, to how those fit into the context of your life and maybe other people in your life. And then you can frame it. So it's just a slightly different process. I wish I had a neat and packaged bundled answer like, oh, do this, step one, step two, step three. But we're literally acknowledging that that's what the problem is. So I'm trying to use a totally different way of approaching the process that just asks a different set of questions.
Yeah, that makes sense. So basically, if I'm getting you right, it has to start with first identifying and knowing what you value and what your goals are before you can do reframing.
Totally. While recognizing that those things are dynamic, they're fluid, they change over time, they exist somewhere on some type of gradient, so it's not all or nothing. There's going to be multiple ones that might overlap or might even run into each other. And then also contextualizing, again, all the parts of your life. You do not exist in a vacuum. You are not sitting in an empty room with a chessboard in front of you. You are a person who lives a life. So there's a lot, there's so many variables, and that's exactly what makes this question hard to answer. But it's not unanswerable. There's a lot of there's a lot of ways to start to ask that set of questions and explore it for yourself.
I love it. So I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but I've had a trend, I guess you could say, or practice for the past year or so with my podcast, where I finish the episode with just a series of fun questions.
Oh, great. It's like the opposite of an icebreaker.
Right.
It's like we have literally ripped everything apart.
We did it in reverse.
Yeah. How did we sew everything back together? Cool. I love it.
I used to call these easy questions, but they turned out to not be so easy all the time for the guests, but they are intended to be fun. So my first question for you is, who is your favorite player of all time?
At chess, just checking. It has to be a chess player.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Preferably.
let me think. That's a hard one to answer. Who's my favorite? Do other people struggle to answer this, Daniel? People are like, it's
about
so
half
hard
the time
to say.
Yeah. That's why I took out me saying these are easy questions. Because this one, some people are like, you know, for 20 years, this has been my favorite player. And other people are like, wow, I've never pinned it down.
The thing I'm going to say that people are not going to believe me. So, JJ, I need you to vouch for me. If anyone comes for me, I need you to hop in because you are my receipts. What I'm about to say was true before our last world championship. But Ding is my favorite player. I loved Ding before he even made it to the candidates. Like, I love Ding's style of play. I love Ding as a person. I love Ding as a player. This is canonical Julia chess trivia. Ding Liren all day.
This is not world champion bandwagon at all, is what you're saying. This predates all that.
JJ, chime in for me. Back me up here.
That's awesome. If you could play a great player of the past who is no longer alive, who would it be?
Oh my God, what do people say to this? That's so hard.
It's a little, I admit it's maybe a little bit of a tougher question. Like the title players, you know, they're like, well, this game from 1920 always impressed me. And so, you know, this player. But
that requires such like an incredible, just complete absence of any humility that like I would be able to recreate any aspect of like a beautiful game with that grandmaster. That is so unhinged. I don't know. I'll say Tal because then I would get to say I did it, you know, get that clout.
He is a popular choice for this question.
Yeah.
If you could play any of the top players in the world right now, who would it be?
Oh my God. Okay, I mentioned this on another pod, so I'll repeat it. I would want to play chess with Eric Rosen. He has a vibe that I find very relaxing. I think it would be a pleasant experience.
That's awesome. I love that.
He's so cool.
And I actually, I might take this out because this will just sound braggy, but I actually got an opportunity to play a Blitz game with him, OTB, in person, and it was awesome. And he is very chill, as you said.
Oh, yeah. That's not braggy at all. Definitely leave that in. That's so cool. And I am jealous.
If you could hang out with any current chess celebrity for an evening, who would it be? I think I know the answer, but I'm asking anyway.
How is that not the same question? Okay, the first question was, who would you want to sit across the board and play chess with? Who would you want to hang out with on the weekend?
First one is top player. So it needs to be like, you know, we're talking one of the best players in the world, you know?
Okay,
this one could even be like
I can't pick JJ.
Botez sister. But I'm sure that was your answer anyway, so I just took it from you.
Okay, so it has to be a top player.
Is top player. This one is just a chess celebrity. Someone who's just known in the chess world. Doesn't have to be a top player.
Oh my God, Daniel, how do you know the answer and I don't know the answer? Were you thinking, I don't know, do they have to have curly hair? What's the question?
Yeah, right.
I know that everyone expects me to say Danya, and because that's what the people want, I'm not going to give it to them. Okay, my answer would definitely be, I think it would be Ben Johnson. Huh? Ben is so nice, but he's also very funny. Ben has a great vibe. I feel like I would enjoy chatting about podcasting. I'm going to go Ben.
Ben is a great answer. I love that. That's perfect.
Very diplomatic.
Okay, so shift here in questions. Going into chess itself, favorite opening as white?
Oh, favorite opening as white as opposed to like what I actually play.
You don't play your favorite opening?
Right? Yeah, there's like something to unpack there, right? I don't know. Do you ever just feel like you're in a mood to goof off and you're like, I'm going to play the grab for 6 or 7 days? That doesn't happen to you?
No, that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, it really depends on what kind of mood I'm in. I feel like the best way I can answer is just to say I'm such an E4 girl. Every time I try to expand into anything else, I don't know. I lose steam. Something doesn't click. You can act like, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I have convinced myself and tried to be like, C4, I should know. I need to explore this foreign exotic terrain. And something happens in my brain and I just hate it so much. And I'm like, nope, not for me. Get me out of here. I'm not doing this.
E4.
So yeah, lots of flavors of E4 suit me.
That's cool. Favorite opening is black.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I talk about this on my podcast a lot. I know that everyone expects me to talk about the Benoni, so I'm also not going to give the people what they want. It's also not my favorite. It's not that those are my favorite games. It's just a setup that, frankly, it's just a setup that I know. So I should probably learn something else. My favorite games as black are for sure Sicilian Khan. Man, I love those structures. I love those games. Frankly, once I really started adopting those positions, I haven't given them up for anything else. So near and dear to my heart.
Okay, so the last question I have for you, I'm a little afraid to ask it now after our conversation today.
Oh my God.
I feel like it's too related in some ways. But
do it.
If a chess genie existed and could grant you any one chess wish, what would you wish for?
Oh my God. I love this question. Like... No, this is the best one.
Okay,
Daniel,
good.
This is the only question on the list that I felt something. This is the only question on the list that I felt a true sense of fun.
Oh no.
The other ones were a little stressful. The other ones were a little buttoned up. No, this is great. Yeah, chess genie, and I have one wish. I would wish that I was better than Magnus Carlsen. No, because then they'll just make Magnus Carlsen bad. Okay, let me think of a better answer.
It just makes him number two.
Is this like a tricky genie?
Where he's trying to like screw you over with.
Yeah, is this a tricky genie who's trying to sabotage you? So you have to be really careful with the wording.
It's not an evil chess genie. It's a benevolent chess genie. He or she just wants whatever is best for you. There's no deceit in it.
I'm going to answer in the most crazy way, but I'm going to follow my heart. People are going to be like, what is happening? I feel like I've had this long, lifelong fantasy. This comes up in so many times in my life, particularly when I'm very busy or very stressed, where I just wish I could have two lives. Like, I want two time courses. I want to be able to stop time. That part of me that wants to study chess so badly, I wish I could live some kind of second life, or I could stop time every time I want to study and play chess and literally spend like an infinite amount of time, however much I want, and devote myself to it. That is so, that is a ridiculous way to respond to you. No. But I've had this, I have fantasized about this exact thing. I wish I had some kind of, I think about stopping time too much. I need to go to therapy.
Well, for what it's worth, I think about stopping time a lot as well. And I've thought about that too for chess, but I don't think I would have considered that as my answer for the chess wish, but I love it. I think that's a great answer.
Because what else would we wish for? Like, I could wish, oh, I wish I had a really high rating. I wish I was 2,900. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that would be cool. That's my second choice. Don't I get three of these?
Normally, yeah, genies typically give you three. So your first one was being better than Magnus. Your second one gives you
No. We have to take that one out. That one's
okay. That didn't count. All right,
doesn't count.
No, go for it. Two more. I like it.
I'm at two. I can stop time when I study chess. I have a second chess life. That feels like it doesn't mean what it sounds like it means. And then I get to just be. I don't know. Honestly, that's it. I'm satisfied. I don't need a third wish.
Very cool. Very cool.
Answer? Do you answer it?
I don't. I've never answered it.
Oh, no. My God. All right. Let's give the listeners what they want.
I've never considered it.
You ask someone this every time you interview them, Daniel, and you have never thought about what your answer would be?
That's correct. I have not. Wow. I have not really. Because I feel like it would take some thought, and I never wanted to put in the effort.
And I have literally just spent the last hour and a half telling you we're going to do a lot of self-inquiry.
Right, and I can't even answer the chess genie question, so clearly I have my work cut out for me.
There's a lot waiting for you there.
That's probably, despite everything we said in this podcast, it probably has to do with improvement or learning. But I feel like that's cheating when you do that. You know, like you're circumventing the process if you do. But it would be cool to like learn at triple the rate or something.
You're like, I wish the chess genie would just make me way smarter.
Basically. Yeah, it's pretty synonymous with that. Yeah.
All right. Me too. That's my third wish. Great. We can share it.
Okay. So if I were to get a second wish, because we're doing three, right?
Go off.
I think just being like a top 20 player and living that life would be awesome. Like, that's one of my dreams, would be to be a top 20 player. Like, if I could have taken chess seriously at age three, like I should have. There's that word should, right?
That's nice to hear you hear it. That's cool.
It would just be, I kind of admire and wish I had that life of one of those top players. It just seems so exciting, traveling the world, playing tournaments, and I don't know, just getting these great experiences. It just seems awesome to me. So being like a top 20 player would be pretty cool.
Right.
I guess that's two. I'm going to take from someone else's answer that I thought was really great. Another guest gave, and they said more confidence when they play. And I thought that was really cool because it wasn't some specific chess skill that we normally think of. But just the idea of just not being unconfident anymore, I thought was really compelling. So I really like that one. I'll take that one as my third.
Okay, brilliant. Oh, I'm so glad that we finally got to turn the microphone back to the famous host.
Right. I appreciate you asking me that question. That was fun.
You appreciate me asking you the question that you designed and created and asked me first. Right. Yes, I will take the credit. Thank you.
Well, no one ever did. That was the first time I've ever answered it. So, yeah, that was fun.
That's why you have to have more podcast hosts on.
Right. They turn the tables around a lot.
Let's turn this monologue into a dialogue.
Exactly. Julia, I had an awesome conversation with you. I really enjoyed everything we talked about. I mean, cool. I went into this. I don't know. We have no idea, right, yet what the audience reaction will be. But I can tell you mine, which is that I went into this already excited about talking with you. And it exceeded my expectations, which were already high. So
Thank you so much for saying that. It's really, that means a lot coming from you.
Thank you. Well, like I said, it was my pleasure having you on the show. I feel like it was a long time coming. I've wanted to talk to you for ever since I started listening to your podcast. I was always compelled by your perspective and your experiences. And so I'm just really excited that we finally got a chance to talk. And I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.